When you ask someone a question and they don't answer you, how does that affect your willingness to trust that person? For instance, if you have a client that owes you money and you call them and email them and ask them if they're planning to pay and you never get a response from them, how does that affect your view of them? You probably begin to lose faith in their good intentions. Trust disappears. Recently, I ran into someone that I hadn't seen for quite some time. And I wasn't sure how they were doing spiritually. So we exchanged a few pleasantries. And I told him I would email him. And so I emailed him about 2 weeks ago and still haven't heard back from him. And that's not the first time that he hasn't responded to me. Well, what does that do to your confidence in somebody's character when you constantly reach out to them and they don't respond? Eventually, you probably stop reaching out. We evaluate whether we can trust someone based on their track record of response. My sister's husband, older brother, let me try that one again. My wife's older brother, Greg, is quite the jokester. He loves to tease. I think he gets it from my father-in-law pretty naturally. Down where I grew up in South Carolina, we have a bug that we don't have up here. We're very grateful we don't have it up here. It's the cockroach. It's common to warmer climates. Contrary to common notion, it doesn't really matter how clean your house is. It doesn't really have to do with cleanliness or dirtiness of your house. Just if you live in a place like that, they're probably going to get in. And we had some experiences with cockroaches down there. But one day we were in our apartment and we had a cockroach or two in. And so I decided that I was going to try and deal with the cockroach infestation. My brother-in-law happened to be in town, and so he went out with me. We went out back one night. It was a hot, humid summer night, and the school had a tunnel system where they would run their pipes and sewers and things like that, and they would have grates periodically where the cockroaches could come out. They could come out of the tunnel system, and so we took a flashlight, and I think we took some Raid or something like that, and we were going to go out and try and at least kill a few of the cockroaches behind our apartment, so maybe they wouldn't get into our apartment. So there were a ton of cockroaches out there that night. We'd shine a flashlight on them and spray them or squash them or whatever we could do. And actually, kind of a fun thing to do. I don't really like cockroaches. I'm willing to try and kill them, but I wouldn't keep them for pets, or I don't have any desire to get real close to them. So we're out there, and I'm focused this way and just looking for another one to come up out of the grate, and I'm gonna squirt them with Raid. And all of a sudden, I feel one on my foot. I had sandals on, and so I begin to shake my foot, and I look down, and it's my brother-in-law. He snuck up behind me with a little leaf from the oak tree and is rubbing my foot. And it felt, I don't know what a cockroach crawling on you feels like, but it seemed like that's probably what it would have felt like. And he got me good. Needless to say, that about put an end to our cockroach hunting for the night. And I've never invited my brother-in-law to go cockroach hunting with me again. Why? Because I know his track record. He has a history. His past actions would lead me to believe that I can't trust him that way. He loves the practical joke, and probably given the opportunity, he'll pull one again. We evaluate whether we can trust people based on their track record. We evaluate God as well, rightly or wrongly. when we ask someone for something and we don't get an answer, or we get an answer that we didn't want, unfortunately, we begin to doubt their character. And finally, we probably stop asking. The question this morning is do any of you view God that way? Maybe you've made requests, and you've pleaded, and you've begged, and you've come back again, and you've kept knocking on the door, and he answered differently than you wanted. Not too long ago, I don't remember if it was in family devotions with our kids or at the dinner table, I don't remember if we were talking about prayer or how the conversation even was instigated. But one of our children, as we were talking about answered prayer and how God answers prayer, piped up and said, "But God didn't heal Mrs. Sweeney's dad, and God didn't heal Daniel Popola." What do you tell a child like that when they've been praying about something and you've been praying about it as a family and a church family, and it seems like God answered differently than you asked him to? Well, some people respond to that by, why bother praying? I've tried it in the past. And if I do get the answer, it's not the answer I wanted. Does God answer prayer? He sure does, every time. Not always the way we want him to, but he always answers. Isaiah 37 or 38 records an answer to prayer that I think will encourage your heart and bolster your faith in the power of God to answer prayer. Isaiah chapter 38 this morning. In Isaiah chapter 38, God gives us two conditions for answered prayer. They're not the only two conditions the Scripture gives us, but the two conditions that are listed in this passage. Two conditions for answered prayer. Taken from the life of King Hezekiah, that chapters 36 and 37 has been covering. A situation where all Hezekiah could do was trust the Lord and pray, and God answered in a mighty way by slaughtering 185,000 of Sennacherib's troops. We're going to back up a little bit in Hezekiah's life, even though Isaiah listed here in chapter 38 and 39, it actually comes just slightly before chapters 36 and 37 in chronology. You say, why would Isaiah do that? Well, it was very intentional to arrange it for the theme, because in the first half of the book of Isaiah, chapters 1 to 35, the foreign power that's constantly oppressing Israel, the biggest threat to Israel is the kingdom of Assyria. And so he deals with God's power over Assyria in chapters 36 and 37 as Hezekiah trusts God. But he shifts the focus at the end of the book to the foreign kingdom that would oppress Israel in the near future, the kingdom of Babylon. And so chapters 38 and 39 introduce Babylon and thus prepare us for the rest of the book. So it wasn't haphazard in any way by Isaiah's part. But I want you to understand that chapters 38 and 39 probably take place just slightly before Sennacherib invading Judah. He may already be in Judah here in chapter 38, but he hasn't made all the threats against Jerusalem. That will come probably in a few months to a year. So we're in the year about 702 BC. Pick up in verse 1. Isaiah records, "In those days, Hezekiah became mortally ill. And Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, came to him and said to him, 'Thus says the Lord, set your house in order, for you shall die and not live.'" So just slightly before the events of chapters 36 and 37, Isaiah is sent by God to give a very sobering message to King Hezekiah. He says, Hezekiah was sick and he was near death. Verse 21 will explain that it involved involves some sort of a boil. Say, that doesn't sound too significant. A boil doesn't kill people usually. Well, this was a pretty heavy-duty type of boil. We don't know exactly what it was, but it's the same word that was used to describe the second plague in Egypt when God sent boils on the Egyptians and Pharaoh. And it was so significant and painful. Remember, the magicians couldn't even stand up to come to Pharaoh. That's how painful it was. It's the same word that was used in Job chapter 2 of God allowing Satan to cover Job's bodies with boil from head to foot. And it's also the same word that's used in Leviticus chapter 13 of a boil that could turn into leprosy. So we don't know for sure what sickness Hezekiah had, but it's so significant it's going to take his life. Wouldn't be surprised if it was some form of leprosy. And so Hezekiah gets this news from Isaiah that he's going to die. What does Isaiah tell him to do? Basically says, get ready. He says there, set your house in order. Give orders to your house is the idea. Got a will, Hezekiah? You better get a will ready. Want to prepare your family for this? You want to prepare the kingdom for this? How would you respond to something like that? Devastation. Hezekiah is devastated. He's probably only 39 years old at this point. 39 years old. I'm 36, so I'm getting pretty close to that. If I got word that next checkup, the doctor says, you've got cancer and you're going to be dead in 3 months, that would be devastating. So verse 2 tells us, then Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and he prayed to the Lord. He doesn't get angry at God. He doesn't go quiet and ignore God. He does what he should do. He prays. Why does he turn to the wall? Probably he's expressing that he wants to be able to talk to the Lord privately. Maybe he doesn't want Isaiah or his servants to see the grief and the overwhelming response that this is having on him. He's young. Manasseh may not even be born at this point, a son who's supposed to reign. Who's going to take the kingdom now? I'm going to die. Don't have an heir. Or he's very young. He's not ready to lead. Not going to give the kingdom to a 3 or 4 year old boy. Natural response that any of us would have. But he turns to prayer. And in verse 3, he prays. And he says, remember now, O Lord, I beseech you, how I've walked before you in truth and with a whole heart. And I've done what's good in your sight. And Hezekiah wept bitterly. He says, please, Lord, I beg you, remember how I've walked before you in truth. Truth means faithfulness. That's the idea of that word there. I haven't been perfect, Lord, but I've been faithful. I've wanted to please you. He said, I've had a whole heart, a complete heart. I've been devoted to you, Lord. This wasn't a half-hearted surrender. I'm fully devoted to you, Lord, though you know I'm imperfect. He says, I've tried to do what's good in your sight. Says, Lord, I know I've lived my life in faithful obedience to you. Basically saying, God, I don't want to die. Even for believers, there's something about death that we try and avoid it as long as we can. Death is the consequence of sin. It's not natural for us as human beings. And so Hezekiah tells us there, weeps greatly. I remember a few years ago when one of the folks in the church spotted a growth or a lump on Lisa's throat that we hadn't noticed before. Thought she should get it checked out, so we took her advice and Lisa got it checked out, but honestly, we weren't expecting anything that significant. And I remember when Lisa got the call from the doctor, she went up to the room, to our bedroom upstairs. She talked to the doctor, and she was up there for quite a while, so I thought maybe I should go up, and I came up and opened the door just as she was hanging up with the doctor, and as tears gently began to flow down her face, she says, "I've got cancer." You never expect that. And we're grateful it was a very insignificant cancer by many respects, thyroid cancer that was easily dealt with and treatable by God's grace. But when you get news like that from the doctor, it turns your whole world upside down. And that's what Hezekiah is experiencing. I'm 39 years old. My kids are young. I don't want to die. And so he cries. God never condemns his tears or his sorrow. God understands. He knows our frame. He remembers that we're dust. As the song said, the Lord Jesus had tears too. So, the parallel passage in 2 Kings chapter 20 records a couple details that Isaiah doesn't record for us because they're not pertinent to his recording of the theme here. But 2 Kings tells us that Isaiah leaves Hezekiah's presence. Hezekiah is praying, doing business with God. Isaiah hasn't even gotten all the way out of the palace, but a word comes from God. Isaiah thinks his job is done. He's headed home, probably feeling the weight of the grief, probably not being too excited about the one having to deliver this message to Hezekiah, being the bearer of bad news. He's leaving the palace, and before he even gets out of the palace, a word comes back from God. Isaiah, go back to Hezekiah because I'm going to give you a message to tell him, and here's the message. Verse 4, the word of the Lord came to Isaiah saying, "Go and say to Hezekiah, thus says the Lord, the God of your father David, I have heard your prayer. I have seen your tears. Behold, I will add 15 years to your life." Why does he mention his father David? Probably a reminder of the Davidic covenant promises from 2 Samuel 7 that your descendants that walk before me, I will honor. And Hezekiah, though imperfectly, has tried to walk with the Lord. He says, "I've heard your prayer and I've seen your tears." Friends, God hears prayers of righteous people. God cares about the burdens of righteous people. He's not indifferent to what happens to us in a sin-cursed world. What do you notice about Hezekiah's prayer here? It's not very long, is it? It's quite short. Piling up words on words on words doesn't necessarily get God's attention. God isn't impressed with fancy language, just mindless repetition. Here, a short prayer was immediately answered by God. It's not wordiness that gets God's attention. And he says, "I will add 15 years to your days, Hezekiah." 54 is a lot better than 39, isn't it? When you know you're about to die, your death is impending, to get the news, "I'll give you 15 more years." That would fill your heart with great joy. So God promises to heal Hezekiah, promises to grant him 15 years extension on his life. And then in verse 6, he gives him another wonderful promise, because that rascal Sennacherib from Assyria is probably already starting to harass Judah and threaten Judah and possibly has already invaded Judah. And so God promises in verse 6, "I'll deliver you and this city from the hand of the king of Assyria, and I will defend this city." He says, "I will deliver you. I will defend this city, so trust me." Maybe you're thinking here, "All right, Pastor Michael, we've gone through the first few verses here, but God hasn't revealed yet why Hezekiah was sick. I mean, what's the cause? Was there some sin in his life? Was it just part of living on a fallen planet? I want you to drop down to verse 17. Verse 17. We get a hint in this passage that though Hezekiah's general desire was to please the Lord, then there may have been something in his life that wasn't right. Because in verse 17, Hezekiah relates for us some of what was going on during this experience for him. He says in verse 17, "For my own peace, I had great bitterness." In other words, this turned out for my own good, Lord. You did this for me for my own good. He says, "It's you who have kept back my soul from the pit of nothingness. You've kept me from dying and going to the grave." Notice what he says in verse 17 as the reason for this. "You have cast all my sins behind your back." We'll find in chapter 39 that Hezekiah, though he was a good man, he wasn't a perfect man, just like us. He struggled with pride, he struggled with a lack of trust, he struggled with sin. And it's possible here in Isaiah chapter 38 that Hezekiah's sickness was a result of some sin in his life. Don't know that for sure, but it certainly would fit the hint we get here in verse 17, where Hezekiah says, "You healed me and you've cast all my sins behind your back." We need to evaluate when we're sick. 1 Corinthians 11 says that sometimes sickness is caused by sin, and we need to evaluate that. You say, "Pastor Michael, is all sickness caused by sin?" Absolutely not. Probably most of our sicknesses in our lives are not directly related to sin and have nothing to do with chastening. But the encouragement is if you are sick and you can think of a sin that has not been dealt with between you and God, deal with it right away. That it's apparent, it appears that's what Hezekiah did. Because he says, "God, you've healed me because you cast all my sins behind your back." And this is the first condition of answered prayer. First condition of answered prayer is that God answers the prayers for believers who confess their sins. David says in Psalm 66, verse 18, "If I regard or hold on to iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me." David says, "I'm wasting my air, I'm wasting my words if there's a sin in my life that as a believer I don't want to let go." And God has put His finger on it through His Word by the conviction of His Spirit, and I say, "No, God, I'm not willing to deal with that." And it appears there was something like that in Hezekiah's life, that God got his attention through the sickness, and Hezekiah immediately dealt with it. That's the first condition of answered prayer. But what's the second condition of answered prayer? Well, I think the prayer itself evidences that for us in Hezekiah's response. The second condition of answered prayer, I want you to drop down to verse 22. Remember, Isaiah is not recording everything for us in chronological order. He's centering it around this theme. But verse 22, "Then Hezekiah said, 'What is the sign I shall go up to the house of the Lord?'" The parallel passage in 2 Kings 20 informs us that at this point, Hezekiah asks for a sign. God has promised he would go back to the temple in 3 days. In other words, Hezekiah, you're not going to die. And two, Hezekiah couldn't go into the temple at this point. Why? Because he was unclean. He was impure because of this boil, because of this sickness. He says, "You're going to get healed. You're going to go back to the temple within 3 days where you want to be to worship me." And Hezekiah asks for a sign. And some of you may be thinking right now, well, wait a second. Remember when Gideon asked for a sign in the book of Judges? And it was actually a lack of faith on Gideon's part. God says, "I'm going to deliver you. I'm going to use you to deliver my people from the Midianites." And Gideon's like, "No way. That's not going to happen. So give me a sign." And he sets out the fleece. And we look at Gideon and say, "Poor Gideon, you doubted." We do that a lot too. But here Hezekiah asks for a sign, and God is not displeased with it at all. Actually, it seems that God is very pleased that Hezekiah has asked for a sign. Why? I think here's the answer. It didn't come from a heart of unbelief. It came from a heart that wanted to give God an opportunity to prove himself powerful. It wasn't a doubt. God, give me a sign or else I won't believe it. And I also think Isaiah is painting a contrast here between Hezekiah and his father Ahaz. Because you remember when God offered Ahaz a sign about 33 years earlier, what did Ahaz do? No, I don't want a sign. I'm not going to test the Lord. Here Hezekiah says, yes, I want a sign because I do believe you, God. And so he asks for a sign. God, can you give me some supernatural confirmation that this is going to happen? I believe it. I just want to give you an opportunity to show your power. So Hezekiah asks, what will the sign be? What's the sign? I'll go back to the temple. Look at verse 7. This will be the sign to you from the Lord, Isaiah tells him. That the Lord will do this thing which he has spoken. He's going to give him two promises. One, he says, I'm going to add 15 years to your life. And then the second promise, he says, I'll save you in Jerusalem from Sennacherib. Two promises, one sign of assurance. What's the sign? Verse 8. He says, behold, I will cause the shadow on the stairway, which has gone down with the sun on the stairway of Ahaz, to go back 10 steps. We don't know if this was a stairway that Ahaz had built especially to serve as a sundial, maybe a double-sided stairway, kind of like a pyramid with a pillar at the top. So as the sun came up, the shadow would go down. We don't know exactly what it was, or if it was just a stairway that was attached to the side of Ahaz's palace. But the sun was setting, and as the sun would go down, of course, the shadow was going down the stairs. 2 Kings 20 records for us that God even gives Hezekiah an option. Ahaz, do you want the sun, the shadow, to go up the stairs? Or do you want the shadow to go down the stairs? 10 steps forward or 10 steps back? I think part of what's going on here is that the sun setting and the shadow declining is a picture of Hezekiah's demise and his soon death. And Hezekiah realizes, he says, well, I mean, it would be supernatural for the shadow to go down 10 steps, but that's the direction it's going anyway, so that's not as big of a miracle. So he says, God, I'd like for you to move the shadow up 10 steps, because that's reversing the course. We don't know how this happened, we just know that God did it. Hezekiah asked for this sign, God does it. That's what Isaiah records there in verse 8, he says, the sun's shadow went back 10 steps on the stairway or the sundial on which it had gone down. You ever seen anything like that? I haven't. Supernatural. God demonstrating his power. What was he trying to communicate to Hezekiah? He's communicating to Hezekiah, Hezekiah, I have the power to do anything, so you can trust me. You're going to be restored to health. You're going to go back to the temple. I'm going to protect you from Sennacherib. Here's what I can do. You can trust me. If I can take care of the sun in the sky and make it do whatever I want it to do, I can take care of your life, Hezekiah. I find it very interesting that this transpired at the stairway of Ahaz, the very person who refused to trust God. His dad refused to trust God. Hezekiah trusted God. Folks, just because your parents may have been deadbeat spiritually doesn't mean that you have to be. You have to make the choice to trust God. The flip side is also true. Just because your parents trusted God doesn't mean that all those blessings will automatically come to you. You must make the choice to trust God. And so God takes it back 10 steps up. Verses 9 to 20 record for us some of what Hezekiah was thinking and praying during this time and how he responded after God healed him. And we'll come back and cover that passage tonight, God willing. But I want you to drop down to verse 21. So what's going to happen? God's made the promise. Hezekiah just has to believe it. So verse 21, Isaiah had said, he's writing in the past tense because he's recording after the fact what had happened. Isaiah had said, let them take a cake of figs and apply it to the boil that he may recover. He will live. Some Bible scholars think that the cake of figs had some medicinal qualities. I'm not sure that it did at all. I think it was just something that God wanted everybody to know that he did it. I don't think the figs had medicinal qualities. I don't think it was a combo of prayer and medicine, though I certainly recommend you go see a doctor when you need to. I don't think the figs had that purpose. I think it was just something that everybody would know. God did it. It wasn't the figs. God did it. He healed him as they smeared it on the boil. Maybe similar to stories in the New Testament where we find Jesus healing people, and on an occasion he would make them do something, and we would look at it and say, that didn't have anything to do with the healing. Like, go rub clay on your eyes and wash it out. Did that have anything to do with the healing? Nothing other than they had to evidence their faith and obedience and trust in the Lord. There's no medicinal properties here, in my opinion. And yet God uses it and heals Hezekiah. And you might be thinking at this point, wow, I wish God answered my prayers that quickly. 5 minutes or less, and I've got an answer. Let me tell you, Pastor Michael, if God answered my prayers that quickly, you better believe I would pray more than I do. Why doesn't it happen this way all the time? We prayed for Daniel Papala, and God decided the best thing was to take him to heaven. Why did Hezekiah get his prayer answered exactly as he wanted it to be, and Daniel Papala didn't? Why doesn't it happen this way all the time? I think there's 5 reasons that our prayers don't get answered the way we want them to or in the time that we want them to. One of those reasons, not connected with the Sweeney situation or the populist situation, sometimes it's our silence. James 4 says, you have not because you don't ask. Sometimes we don't get answered prayer because we don't ask God to do it. Sometimes our silence is the problem. Sometimes sin keeps us from receiving answered prayer. Sin that we're holding on to in our life that we don't want to deal with. Psalm 66, verse 18. Could be silence. It could be sin. Could be selfishness. Do we ever pray selfishly? Sometimes we do. James 4 goes on and says, you have not because you ask not. You ask amiss that you may spend it on your own lusts and pleasures. Sometimes we don't get an answer to prayer because it's all about me and all self-focused, and God chooses not to answer that to reward selfishness. Sometimes it's silence. Sometimes it's sin. Sometimes it's our selfishness. Sometimes there's a delay in answering prayer because of spiritual warfare. We see this in the example of Daniel with the prince of Persia. We don't understand how it all works and why, but spiritual warfare sometimes brings a delay in the answer to prayer, and we just need to wait. Sometimes God has amazing purposes for us. He always does in delaying answers to prayer. I was thinking, what's the longest I've ever prayed for something before God answered it? Where he said, wait, wait, wait. I didn't know what was going on, but through circumstances, he was saying, wait. Longest I can come up with is about 7 years praying for something. Praying for something for 7 years and nothing happening. seemingly. Praying, coming back to God. Not every day, but periodically, of this burden that I had, something that needed to be dealt with. Pray, nothing. Pray, nothing. Second year, third year, fourth year, fifth year, sixth year. And you know what? In the seventh year, out of the blue, here's the answer. Was that coincidental? Oh, it's very intentional on God's part. There's another reason that sometimes God waits to answer our prayer or answers them in a different way. The fifth S is God's sovereignty. Sometimes we ask God for something and He says, no, I have a better way. And I think that's what happened with Daniel Popola. God said, I hear your prayers, but I'm going to give you a different answer than maybe you want because I have a better way. That's sovereignty. And what do you do with sovereignty? You don't fight it. You don't get angry at it. You don't question it. You do what Hezekiah did, and you trust. You trust. This passage is all about trusting God. What's the second condition to answered prayer? The second condition to answered prayer is not only does God answer prayer, the prayer of believers who confess their sins, God answers prayer of believers who trust in Him. Who trust in Him. So friends, you may not get a 5-minute answer like Hezekiah got, and that's okay. Those 5-minute answers are wonderful. Doesn't always happen that way. You may get a delay, but a delay isn't necessarily a no. You may pray 7 years, you may pray 50 years. I remember a couple years ago, someone connected to a person in the church came to the Lord, turned from their sins and believed in Jesus after his wife had prayed for him for 41 years. What was she thinking during that time? Is God hearing my prayer? Is God going to answer? We know God doesn't force people to come to Him. But it was a wait. It was a wait. It was a delay. He wasn't saying no. He was saying wait. So what do? You trust and you wait. Maybe you've been praying about a particular need and it seems that God isn't giving the request, the answer that you're looking for. Instead of beginning to doubt His character and think that He's not trustworthy and why bother praying, I've tried it before and it doesn't work, you trust His sovereignty. You trust His sovereignty. And this passage shows us just how quickly God can answer prayer. That He'll even at times send the answer on its way before we even pray. So it's up to God if He decides to say yes right now, or yes, but wait a little bit, or no, trust me in my sovereignty. That's God's business. My job is simply to confess sin and trust Him as I wait. The lesson of this passage, I believe, is that because God listens to the righteous, we must pray. We must trust Him enough to pray. Prayer is an evidence that you trust God. Would you bow your heads, please? Sometimes God allows sickness in His sovereignty on a fallen planet to teach us. It's not connected to any kind of sin on our part. You just have to trust. Okay, Lord, this isn't what I've asked for. This isn't what I would want. But I'll trust your sovereignty. If you heal me, if you take it away, wonderful, I'll praise you. And if you don't, I'll praise you too. You're always good. I'll trust. Maybe because you've prayed about certain needs, certain desires, and God has said, wait, time's not right. Or He said, no, I've got a better plan. Maybe you begin to doubt God's character, and you're probably not thinking, I don't trust God anymore, but by your actions and your prayerlessness, you are. The fact that you don't get on your knees regularly or go on a walk to pray, or you don't join in with corporate prayer, evidences the fact that you really don't think prayer makes a difference. And essentially you're saying, we don't have a prayer answering God. He may answer other believers' prayers, but he doesn't answer mine. One of the conditions for answered prayer is trust, faith, believing what God has said. So friends, if prayerlessness in your life is reflective of your lack of trust in God, or if there's sin that's keeping you from praying or receiving answered prayer, deal with those today. God's not looking for perfection. Hezekiah wasn't anywhere close. He just wants someone who will confess their sin and humbly trust him. God answers prayer. Do you believe that? Do you pray like it? Why not start praying like it right now? Lord, maybe there's some kids here today that really haven't done a lot of praying, and you're working in their hearts. You're speaking to them through your word, telling them to start praying and trust you. Pray that there would be many kids that would start praying and have a lifelong ministry of prayer. Maybe there's some teenagers here that are learning to pray and want to grow in, and I ask that you would help them. You bless them with answered prayer and show your faithfulness. Maybe there are some adults here that used to pray but gave up on it, quit on it. I pray that you would use your word to remind them of your power and your desire to answer prayer. Lord, make us a praying people. Make us a trusting people. And we'll give you the glory. In Jesus' name, amen.